Hello, and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Harassment allegations rock Parliament Hill. An NDP staffer is suing her former MP, claiming there was sexism and unfair treatment in the office. This comes following two Liberal MPs being suspended after accusations of personal misconduct by two NDP MPs. We speak with New Democrat Whip Nicole Turmel.
Dean Del Mastro has resigned as an MP, just hours before the House of Commons was to vote on a motion to suspend him for breaking election laws. McLean's panel discusses Del Mastro's decision to quit and the problem with his pension.
Remembrance Day is approaching, with the terror attack in Ottawa still fresh in our minds. We speak with the Veterans Affairs Minister about how the government will honour the two soldiers killed in the recent attacks, and we speak with an NDP MP about his bill to make November 11th a national holiday.
We also get reaction from the Sex Professionals of Canada after the government's prostitution bill became law, and we speak with an MP who is trying to bring back the long-form census.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. Serious harassment allegations have led to two MPs being suspended from the Liberal Party, and in a separate incident, a former New Democrat staff member has filed a lawsuit against the MP she used to work for. Now we'll start with the most recent issue, which is the lawsuit. A former staffer, Fabiola Farrow, is suing New Democrat MP Sylvain Chiquan, alleging Chiquan demonstrated a sexist attitude and unfairly fired her after she complained about harassment from another employee.
Court documents show Farrow claims Chiquan didn't deal with her complaints about her colleague harassing her, and that led to a poisoned, unhealthy, and toxic workplace. Farrow made an unsuccessful complaint to her union and claims the party offered her a job in the leader's office in exchange for her agreement to drop the complaint. None of the allegations have been tested in court.
NDP leader Thomas Mulcair addressed the lawsuit while making another announcement at a daycare in Saskatchewan.
It's very important to understand that this is not a question of an allegation of harassment against a member of parliament. It's cross accusations of harassment between two employees. It's already been dealt with under the collective agreement, and it was decided that nothing further needed to be done. If somebody wants to try to take that to court, I'll let the courts deal with it. But because we take these things seriously, we have a collective agreement and it's been dealt with fully.
This news came just 2 days after two MPs, Scott Andrews and Massimo Pacetti, were suspended from the Liberal caucus over allegations of personal misconduct by two women NDP MPs.
The Liberals wrote a letter to the Speaker of the House of Commons Wednesday morning, informing him of the suspensions and asking him to look into the matter. Both Andrews and Pacetti deny these allegations. Liberal leader Justin Trudeau spoke to the media after his party's caucus meeting.
In one of the cases, that information was conveyed to me personally and directly by one of the affected MPs from another party on October 28th. Immediately, I directed our whip, Judy Foote, to make her counterpart in the other party aware of the allegations that had been conveyed to me. She did so promptly. On October 30th, she met with the two affected MPs of the other party and their whip. During the course of that meeting, both MPs confirmed the personal misconduct allegations against Mr. Pacetti and Mr. Andrews. I am aware of how difficult it is for people to come forward. I believe strongly that those of us in positions of authority have a duty to act upon allegations of this nature. It's 2014. We have a duty to protect and encourage individuals in these situations to come forward. The action must be fair, but decisive. It must be sensitive to all affected parties, but recognizing how difficult it is to do so, it must give the benefit of the doubt to those who come forward.
But the NDP is upset with the Liberals for making this issue public, saying the two women were never given a heads up this would happen, and it's not what they wanted. NDP whip Nicole Turmel has been handling these allegations for her party. I was able to speak with her at her office.
Okay, so Ms. Turmel, first off, I'm just wondering if you could tell me how the MPs involved are doing right now and whether they have received any help or counseling since the incidents that they went through.
I'm not sure about the counseling they have right now. All I can say, they are with their families or their friends, and I cannot say they are doing well. They are still in a shock of the news they heard last Wednesday. We're talking to them every day, trying to help them and suggesting to them to do whatever they need, counseling or whatever, to feel better.
Let's start then about when you first heard the allegations, when they were brought forward to you. Liberal Scott Sims has confirmed to us that that he first heard about one of the allegations in March of 2013. When did you first hear about the allegations?
I heard about it in the spring sometime. I cannot say it was March or April, but I'm not sure about that. I knew that one of them was not feeling well, but I didn't know what it was about. Even when I heard about it, I didn't have any details. I didn't have the names of the MPs involved or anything, just that something happened and that she needed help. So we tried as much as we could to help her out. Then the second one I heard about is when I met with Mrs. Foote. And that's where I learned that there was a second MPs, one of us, that was involved in a case.
So with that first case, did you not want to take action or do anything? Why did it take so long for something to happen in terms of action?
Yeah, I would say that it is normal in those circumstances. If you talk to women who have been abused or face problems, that it could take years before they are ready to go public. For them, on top of being MPs, we are public figure. So it's quite difficult, and they have to accept. They have to go through a process. Our role was to make sure we supported them and that we were there for them, but not imposing anything on them. We wanted them to feel safe. We wanted them to feel that we were there for the four. That was our main point.
You didn't know that it was a Liberal MP that was involved in that first case?
I remember asking the question if it was one of us, and she said no. That's the only thing I knew.
So the second case then, an MP approached Justin Trudeau personally. You're not happy with the way the Liberals dealt with it after that point. What is the issue that you have with how everything went down?
The point is not that they went public. The point is that the women who were affected by this were not informed. And I want to make it clear, it's not about what they did. It's about what they did not do. And they did not advise the victim, or they did not advise us that it was coming out and there will be a public press conference. So we were not able to help the women who heard about it through the social media. And that's what is difficult for them. And that's why now they are still in a shock. And we're talking to them every day, trying to help them. But still, they are still in a shock.
Did the MPs involved, I mean, this is a very public business. And a lot of things that happen even behind closed doors ends up becoming public. Did they not expect this to go public?
They didn't want it to go public. It's clear. That's why they didn't want to come forward, because they knew and they know that we are public figure. So they were trying to deal with it. They were trying, one of them at least, I said, I won't go public. I'll take care of myself. And that's what we respected. So this coming out like this, it's a shock. I cannot say at one point we agree that everything becomes public because of our role, our job. But at the same time, at least a minimum of respect is expected for those who are investigating, who made the decision to go public.
But were there not discussions to let them know that there's a very good chance this could go public simply because of the nature of the business we're in?
The only thing the other whip, Mrs. Foote, said is that she'll go and talk to her to Mr. Trudeau. They will ask questions. They will meet with the MPs involved, but at any time they said they will go public with it. And that's really sad. That part is really terrible, because they should have thought about it. And I was expecting Mrs. Foote to come back to me. And when she did it, she gave me an envelope. It was between 9:30 and 10. She gave me a note, strictly confidential. And when I walked back in the caucus room, it was already public. So strictly confidential, and all the medias are aware. I am really, really shocked about that.
Did the two women involved, did they want to see sanctions or something done by the Liberals with the MPs that are accused of this personal misconduct?
The question was raised with one of them, at least the two of them, I should say. They were not, they didn't want anything. They want this to go away. They wanted to take care of themselves, and they wanted to make sure that nobody else faced that kind of situation.
So they weren't looking for suspensions?
They were not looking for suspension. What they were looking for is that the other caucus, the Liberal, took whatever action they thought of to take care of that part. That's all they wanted. They said, it's not for us to tell you what to do. You have to deal with it.
So let's talk about the route forward now, because it is public, it's out there. The specific details of the allegations alone haven't come out, but there will be a process moving forward with the Speaker looking into this, the Board of Internal Economy is going to look into this. What is the process forward? How is this going to be handled?
It's amazing, the question, because it raises a lot of points. First, the House of Commons doesn't have any process to deal with this. Mr. Scheer said, okay, we'll see. We'll just bring it to the Board of Internal. I'm not saying the Board of Internal Economy will look at these cases. They will look at what we do now, how we can make sure that we have a policy that will help everybody. But where we are with these cases, I don't know really.
But the Speaker is looking into these specific allegations, correct?
Not really. He didn't say to us that he will look at it. He said that we have unprecedented cases that we have to look at, but he didn't give us any indication where he's going with it.
So then are we sort of in a state of limbo on these allegations? If we have two suspended MPs, at least one of them who didn't want this to deal with this in the way that it's being dealt with right now. If they don't want to come forward and make a formal complaint and you can't substantiate the allegations against the two Liberal MPs, I mean, what happens then? Are we just stuck?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure really, because this is the decision of Mr. Trudeau. So himself, he will have to take the next step, how he will deal with this issue. So you have the two MPs as well who will have to decide what their move is, and I'm not sure about that either. And I'm not in their caucus, so I'm not aware of anything. On our side, if our MPs don't want to put a complaint in, we'll have to deal with it. We'll have to deal how they survive in all this, and that's what we are looking at. Right now, the two MPs are not ready to answer any questions about what they do now. They want to feel comfortable. They want to do whatever is needed. And at the same time, when I say that, we ask them what they want to do, and they don't know. They are not sure.
That was NDP Whip Nicole Turmel.
The allegations of misconduct have sparked a broader discussion about harassment on Parliament Hill. Green Party leader Elizabeth May, New Democrat Nikki Ashton, Conservative Stella Ambler, and Liberal Hedy Fry share their thoughts.
Certainly the bullying has gotten worse. And I think there's always been a problem, and I would say the problem of, which is not a small problem, of people who are reporting to a boss who engages in uncomfortable sexual innuendo and comment, everything from that which is unacceptable right through to direct unwanted sexual physical advances. That's been, I think, part and parcel of politics around here for a long time. It's not acceptable. And I would say that applies to young men and young women on Parliament Hill going back a long way.
It's an antagonistic culture, and certainly many women stay away from it. I think that, I wouldn't say that what we're living here is different from what the rest of Canadian society is going through. I think it is connected. I think it is a reflection. I think in some ways, compared to other workplaces, it can be worse.
That hasn't been my experience, but I will say that even if it's, regardless of how prevalent it is, and I don't know, I would say even one incident has to be taken very seriously and has to be dealt with.
I think harassment is to do with power. It happens in any workplace, and I don't think Parliament is immune to it. I think, as we all know, harassment is an abuse of power. So wherever there are people with power and people without, there will be harassment.
One issue that came to light following the suspensions is that the Liberals and NDP say there is no formal policy for MPs to file complaints against other MPs. The Speaker's office has issued a statement saying there is a process for House employees. Anyone working in the House of Commons can request a confidential meeting with the Chief Human Resources Officer. That is also available to MPs if they make that request. Nonetheless, the Board of Internal Economy is looking at creating policies to deal specifically with MPs.
University of Toronto sociology professor Sandy Welsh is one of Canada's leading experts on workplace sexual harassment. She doesn't address this specific case, but does speak with Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes about proper procedures to deal with the issue.
What works best and what the research shows is proactive policies and procedures that actually encourage reporting. These are policies that have effective complaint processes that may say, when this type of behavior happens and it is this type of employee, we're going to do such and such. Or when it is a behavior that has been engaged in or an allegation against a manager or someone more senior in the organization, that this may be something where we want to bring in an internal investigation.
What do you think when you hear about a case where a woman who has a complaint says, I don't want to go into a formal process?
I think that is a version that happens more frequently than people may realize. There can be a number of issues at stake. One may be this person, for whatever reason, doesn't feel comfortable or isn't in position where they want to go forward with a formal complaint. They may want just simply to say to someone, I just want you to know that this is going, that this is happening. I don't want to do anything about it right now. One of the things that we know from when women make that decision to make a formal report, often it's because there's either an escalation in behavior that's been happening or something has happened that is so severe. It's reached the level of severity in terms of its effect on their career, on their work, or it's in the category of a sexual assault, which starts to get us into criminal harassment. Right. That's when they will report. I also think, though, that managers and employers have a responsibility to listen to what their employees are saying and to hear an informal complaint. But if they feel that what has happened is so egregious that something really should be done, that their independent responsibility towards under the Human Rights Code, and as an employer, that they need to look into this, then sometimes those are conversations they need to have with the person who's come forward, and they have to make their decision with an understanding of what their responsibility is.
So even if the person who's lodging the complaint says, no, I don't want this to become a formal process, there might be instances where the managers listening to it have to say, no, this is too serious. We need to act in some formal way.
I think that they may not say that in that meeting, but they may say, I'm going to, you know, thank you. I'm going to, I'm concerned about this and make sure that person has support, do all the consulting they need to do. But if it is clear that this is something that is very serious and someone is either, you know, has been putting up with something for a very long time or it is not a safe situation for them in terms of the allegations that they've made, then I think there are times when an employer is really required to act.
One thing that did surprise a lot of people, at least a lot of people in the media here, is that I think if you'd ask people to guess what sort of sexual harassment allegations might arise in the Hill, they would have guessed MPs harassing staffers, that somebody in an obvious position of authority might be harassing junior staff members. This was the allegations involve MPs who in both cases were kind of basically backbench MPs, people of very similar status. What do you think of that? Does that change the nature of an investigation? Does it change the nature of the way that you'd approach an issue like this?
This is around coworker harassment. Sometimes those are, depending on the nature of the allegations, there are times when those are best handled through informal mechanisms or through conversations with the individuals as to what is happening.
I'm a little confused about the borderlines between a sort of well-laid-out official process where somebody who brought a complaint would have an idea in advance, like, this is how this is going to be handled. I'm going to tell this person there's going to be an investigation, you know, something where you understand what track you're on, and something more informal. I can see benefits to both, but I could imagine that if I was a woman who'd been harassed, I might want to know, you know, before I launched a complaint, like, well, what is going to happen now? If I do this, what am I getting into? Does that make sense, or would it be better to leave things more loose and informal so people could adapt to the wishes of people involved?
Well, I think it might be useful for when a manager or an HR person is someone comes in and says, I'd like to talk to you about something. That person could first engage and say, this is the constraints of this. And I have seen in action people in these roles who will say to someone who's bringing forward the allegations, you know, you may choose not to do anything with this. You may choose to want to go forward. But if you tell me anything of that involves X, Y, and Z, then I am legally required to go forward with this.
That was McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaking with University of Toronto Sociology Professor Sandy Welsh.
Still to come on the show, the McLean's panel weighs in on the resignation of MP Dean Del Mastro. We look at a bill that would make Remembrance Day a national holiday. Sex workers react after the government's prostitution bill becomes law. And we talk to an MP that wants to bring back the long-form census.
Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Still to come on the show, we look at a new bill to make Remembrance Day a national holiday. We speak with sex workers about the government's prostitution bill becoming law. And we talk to a Liberal MP who's trying to bring back the long-form census. But first,
it's now time for the McLean's panel. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host Aaron Wary, the Associate Editor of McLean's, as well as the McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief, John Geddes. Thank you very much for joining us.
Good to be here.
All right, we're going to start off with these allegations that came forward on Wednesday. It's kind of a messy situation. John, where do we really go from here when we have two MPs who don't want to file formal complaints, two MPs suspended from their caucus, facing the allegations, but no process to move forward to resolve this issue?
I mean, I guess to underscore this lack of a process, where it now sits is apparently with the Board of Internal Economy of the House of Commons, a secretive body that normally does not deal with anything approaching this. It really was set up to deal with money matters to do with the House, not this. Why have they gone to the board? Well, there's no other process. There doesn't seem to be anything else in place, that any other situation in place that could deal with this. It's very problematic. We've got victims who wish it hadn't gone this route. One presumes that the guys who have been accused, the two MPs who have been accused of things, wish it hadn't gone this route. Who has benefited from it coming out the way that it has? I guess in the very abstract, you might argue that it's good that things like this in general are coming to light in this public debate. But boy, for the people specifically involved, this just looks like a mess with no clear way forward. One might be willing to sit back and say, well, maybe there's no way forward. Maybe this is something that's just going to have to be allowed to not come to some kind of resolution. Unfortunately, that really isn't possible. We've got two MPs who have been suspended. They're not going to be allowed to run as things stand right now in the next campaign. Their reputations are obviously badly damaged by this already. So there's no option here where the party leaders can allow this to just somehow fizzle away and not be dealt with. At some point, I think Mr. Mulcair and Mr. Trudeau need to get together and decide how they want to deal with it. I don't think it can be dealt with neutrally as a House of Commons matter, because I don't think the House of Commons has a procedure for it. So I think the parties should put their heads together and think how they want to do it.
And earlier, Nicole Turmel, the NDP whip, had said that the BOIE may just be looking more at the process and fixing the processes rather than dealing with these specific allegations.
Right.
So, I mean, before long, Trudeau will have to make a decision as to what he does with these two MPs. He's sort of stuck in a hard place if this is still left in limbo.
Yeah, it's tough to know how this moves forward, as John said. It seems from the outside, watching the situation, it seems that a lot of the onus is now on these two women to decide what they want to do. And to a certain degree, maybe their hands have been forced. Maybe they have to do something now to move this forward. I think there is a discussion to be had about how this rolled out on Wednesday and over the week previous to that. Obviously, it's an incredibly emotional situation, and it's an incredibly difficult situation, and there would seem to be a lot of anger going back and forth on this. But I do think you have to go back and look at that Wednesday and say, okay, well, you know, should Mr. Trudeau have gone to the women and talked to them beforehand to say this is what I'm going to do? I don't even know whether I have actual good answers for those questions, but I think you kind of have to go back and pick the whole thing apart and figure out, you know, sort of where this all kind of went sideways, because I don't think anyone is really in a position now where they're happy with the situation.
All right, and we're going to switch gears here to touch on Dean Del Mastro. He has resigned as an MP for the riding of Peterborough. This, of course, after being convicted of breaching election laws. He's facing sentencing November 21st, and he decided just hours before MPs were going to vote on a motion to suspend him that he would rather resign. Were you surprised by this, Aaron, when he stood in the House and gave his emotional speech? And then also, what of his pension?
I was completely surprised. I'd actually, at some point in question period, I'd looked over to his seat to see if he happened to be there, because obviously this vote on a suspension was coming up, and he wasn't there. So at some point late in question period, he sort of slipped in, and I don't remember any kind of commotion in the House about him being there. It was just sort of suddenly there was Dean Del Mastro. That speech he gave is a remarkable sort of moment for the House. I mean, it was emotional and it was personal, and it was, you know, he tried to defend himself and he tried to, it felt like he wanted to kind of, if he was going to go out, which he was, he wanted to go out on his own terms and having said his piece. And I guess to a certain degree he did that. But I think it's important to remember that he was going out. It looked like that suspension vote was going to go against him. And I suspect that, short of an absolute discharge or a conditional discharge from the judge, he was probably looking at expulsion. Now, of course, that raises the issue of his pension. If I read the law the way other people seem to be reading the law, it's that if he'd been expelled from the House of Commons, he lost his pension. Whereas if he quits, he gets to keep his pension. So you can read into that all sorts of reasons for maybe why he quit when he did. I can't get in his brain and tell you what he was thinking. He would have had more time conceivably to resign, I would think, even after he'd been suspended. But, I mean, all things considered, it was a remarkable, I can't think of anything I've seen sort of in the last 7 years that I've been in Ottawa that quite matches that sort of 14 minutes that he was on his feet in the House.
The pension issue is one that we have to face still going forward with some of the senators involved. Patrick Brazeau being the one who's going to be facing his charges first, but I think it's January, he hits that six-year mark, and he's eligible for his pension. So he may be able to resign after that, keep his pension before being convicted of any crime.
Correct me if I'm wrong, guys, but when Matt Carr resigned from the Senate, was this not an issue then? He was preserving his pension, was he not, by stepping down when he did? So it is something that has to float into people's minds, let's face it, when they're in this situation. There's a lot of money at stake there.
Thanks very much, guys. John Geddes, the Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief, Aaron Wherry, the co-host and associate editor for Maclean's, and I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
Remembrance Day is approaching, and this year the solemn ceremony at the National War Memorial will be all the more significant. November 11th comes just 3 weeks after two separate attacks on Canadian soil that claimed the lives of two members of our military. Corporal Nathan Cirillo will be in the thoughts and prayers of those who gather for the annual ceremony at the War Memorial, the very place where he was gunned down in the Ottawa terror attack.
Veterans Affairs Minister Julian Fantino lay a wreath there in a ceremony for Veterans Week. I was able to speak with him afterwards about what the government plans to do to honor the two soldiers.
Well, there are considerations underway. I don't know that we'll be able to do anything right this year, but there are considerations to commemorate not only him, but also Warrant Officer Vincent in Quebec. So those discussions are ongoing. We just don't know what is it's going to be, but there are those discussions ongoing.
What are some of the options? I know there's a petition right now for a plaque.
Well, we just don't know where we're going to land on this issue. Suffice to say that we will be finding some way of recognizing both, probably in the next year or so, something will be done.
Meanwhile, there's an attempt to make Remembrance Day a national holiday. The bill by the NDP's Dan Harris passed second reading in the House of Commons by a vote of 258-2. It now goes to a committee for further study before coming back to the House for a vote. I spoke with Harris in the foyer of the House of Commons.
What this does tell Canadians is that we as parliamentarians believe that Remembrance Day should be elevated to the same footing as Victoria Day and Canada Day in our national importance. And certainly at the federal level, it'll mean that it'll be a statutory holiday all across the federal government and federally regulated industries, which will be fantastic. Now, of course, most of the government already has the day off, so it doesn't actually lead to a huge change there. But it does certainly tell the provinces that we believe it should be a holiday. But it's up to them to decide. And, you know, provinces have already, in some cases, chosen different ways to do it. In Manitoba, you have businesses have to be closed from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. In Nova Scotia, they actually have their own Remembrance Day Act, which fairly clearly stipulates which businesses can and can't be open on that day. And, of course, in Nova Scotia, they did it because they thought that kids should be in school. And so they've always maintained that. And every province will have a chance to commemorate in their own way.
They've always had that opportunity, though. So what does this really change, if anything at all?
Well, it what it does at the federal level is it elevates it up to the same status as Canada Day and Victoria Day. Certainly, I think, on the 100th anniversary of the start of the First World War, and obviously given recent tragic events, there's a lot more importance that's placed on our troops and the sacrifices that they make. But also we have 40,000 relatively fresh new veterans from Afghanistan, and it's a great opportunity for us to rededicate ourselves to them.
For regular Canadians, this doesn't change much anything at all unless the provinces actually agree to make changes themselves.
The ones that don't already have it as a statutory holiday. One of my friends who lived her whole life in Newfoundland, Labrador, and British Columbia and only moved to Ottawa 3 weeks ago, she was quite surprised to find out it wasn't a statutory holiday because she's always experienced it as being a holiday. So for many Canadians, this won't change anything. It's nothing new. They already have that holiday. And the chance to go and pay the respects. But hopefully in Ontario and Quebec, they'll have that chance soon.
There has been some pushback to your bill, though, and some criticism. People say people may get off the day off of work, but they may just stay at home. They may not actually take part in the spirit of Remembrance Day. And by keeping kids in school, let's say, they would actually be forced to be educated about the whole thing.
The education, again, that the curriculum lies with the provinces, and you just have to look in the provinces that already have it as a statutory holiday, like Newfoundland and Labrador. They spend an entire week teaching the kids about Remembrance Day and the importance before the day itself, where they can go to ceremonies and services. In Ontario, where it's not a holiday, if Remembrance Day falls on a weekend, then the kids do it in the last school day before Remembrance Day, so they still get the education. In terms of whether the day would have less meaning if it was a holiday, that's up to Canadians. It's whether it's a holiday or not, it's up to Canadians to show the importance of the date and to remember and to commemorate the incredible things that our armed forces have done over the years.
That was NDP MP Dan Harris speaking about his bill to make Remembrance Day a national holiday.
Coming up after the break, sex workers aren't happy the government's prostitution bill has now become law, and the long-form census could make a comeback.
Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
This week, the government's prostitution bill passed in the Senate and received royal assent, meaning it is now law. Our old prostitution laws were struck down by the Supreme Court because they put sex workers in danger. Valerie Scott is with the Sex Professionals of Canada, and she's one of the three sex workers that launched the original legal challenge. She believes the new law will just make the situation worse.
We're raging. I mean, it's just, it was devastating at the same time. federal government has said very plainly that they wish to legislate us out of existence. We're an entire community of people, and I just don't think that's right to have, we're practicing what is still a lawful and legal profession, but yet you're trying to eradicate us.
And you're talking about the rules that would make it illegal for sex workers to work in areas, anywhere where kids would reasonably be, such as parks, schools, things like that.
Well, not that sex workers tend to work in those areas anyway, but we can still be captured under those laws. But by making it illegal for our clients to have consensual adult sex with us means the client is going to want to remain a moving target. And he is going to want to go to dark, out-of-the-way, more like industrial zone kind of places. And like any business, we go where our clients are, and that's where we will end up. And we all know that's not a good way to work. Negotiation time will be eliminated because of fear of arrest.
Yeah, so are you going to be challenging this new law? Are you going to start another challenge in court?
It depends. We won't be able to do it right away because it's dangerous to go to court without an evidentiary record, meaning that we will have to spend the next 2 or 3 or 4 years amassing evidence of rapes, beatings, and murders of our colleagues, and then present all of that evidence to the court.
So you'll have to wait to see how this pans out to then show the court what the issues are with the new law to start that legal challenge.
That's right. So what the federal government is banking on is we won't be able to do that. You know, it takes time, right? And the body count won't be high enough for several more years. And meanwhile, they'll be safe in the upcoming 2015 federal election.
But you are planning to take legal action. I guess it's just the plans are starting now to take further legal action years down the line?
Yes, we are. I'm not sure if it will be us exactly. It might be our colleagues in BC are looking at it. But it'll be, some of us. I'm just not sure which group. It doesn't really matter as long as we'll all be working together. And, so we'll take it back up. I think the first thing we'll likely see in court is the ban on advertising because newspapers can't really take that financial hit. The organization that monitors revenue for Canadian newspapers has estimated that the publication industry will take between a 12 and 14% annual hit on this. And they simply can't do that in this day and age. They can't take that kind of financial loss.
That was Valerie Scott with the Sex Professionals of Canada.
In a controversial move in 2010, the Harper government eliminated the mandatory long-form census, saying it was too intrusive. Now, 4 years later, a Liberal MP is trying to bring it back. Ted Hsu has a bill before the House of Commons that would restore the questionnaire. I met up with Hsu on Parliament Hill.
We need to have good information about ourselves in order to govern ourselves wisely. The mandatory long-form census gives us good information because without the mandatory nature, certain groups, so rural residents, single-parent families, the very rich, the poor, young people, tend not to return the census. And that gives a biased result. And there are effects to that. And that error that the bias introduces has effects. New Brunswick earlier this year said that it was having a hard time evaluating what value for money it was getting out of its poverty program, the effects of its poverty program, because of the elimination of the mandatory long-form census. And I can give you another example of why the mandatory long-form census is important. If you want to look at the correlation between education attainment and income, you can get education attainment by looking at graduation records. You can get income by looking at tax records. But if you want to connect the two, then you have to ask individuals the two questions at the same time. So you have to do a survey. And you care about people in those groups that I mentioned, the poor, single-parent families, young people, rural residents. You want to know what correlation they have between educational attainment and income. If you want to design policies around education or affordable housing or public health, how do you spend public health dollars as efficiently as you can? And that's why a lot of organizations, hundreds of organizations, lined up to oppose the elimination of the mandatory census in 2010.
So I guess the arguments against the mandatory long-form census, I guess, are kind of twofold. First, the questions are intrusive, and some of the questions, you know, are asking for personal information that people shouldn't be forced to disclose. And second, that there's this penalty attached to it, either jail, even though it's never been imposed, jail time or a monetary fine. I guess, how do you deal with those two arguments?
Well, my bill just gets rid of the jail term. And instead, there's a fine that goes up to $500. So it's like a speeding ticket, and with the points and the insurance and the cost of all that. So it's like a bad speeding ticket. But the thing is that I view having good information as something that we need for good government. And if you want to live in a country where the government has good information to govern wisely, then when people don't fill out the census, like when it's voluntary, the people who have not filled out the voluntary census, and we know how bad the data is from that voluntary census now, because researchers have looked at it and called it worthless, called the income data worthless. You're actually doing a disservice to your country by not filling out the census.
Do you have any sense of, if the government doesn't support the bill, you may be able to get conservative votes? You know, the reality of this situation is in the House that you could get the Liberals and you could get all of the NDP and you could get all the independents, and you're still going to need maybe a dozen conservatives to get the bill passed.
Yeah, that's a very good question. There are conservative MPs that I won't name who support restoring the mandatory long-form census, who understand the importance of having good reliable data. But it will be an uphill struggle because it is asking the government to reverse a policy that it put down 4 years ago. But, you know, Mr. Harper has reversed things in the past, so maybe this is the time where we can maybe come to a compromise.
That was Liberal MP Ted Hsu talking about his bill to bring back the mandatory long-form census. Now, after I spoke with Hsu, his bill was debated Friday afternoon, and the government signaled it won't be supporting the bill. That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.